Hello, listeners. Nina here to talk to you about Sincere Notes. Oftentimes, we really want to be in touch with friends for important dates. We are not trying to forget. We are not trying to be thoughtless, but we didn't schedule it. Sincere Notes is an app that allows you to schedule future messages so that you can stay in touch as often as you want and really be there for those important moments. And I'm not just talking about birthdays, although obviously birthdays are a great place to start and a subject I hear a lot about, but also something like grief anniversaries, a big surgery coming up, the anniversary of somebody's sobriety. Sincere Notes was developed for that, and it's a really easy, seamless app. It's not complicated at all to set up. You will find it a breeze to use. You can find Sincere Notes available to download for free on Google Play or the App Store. Check it out. And now on to the show. Welcome to Dear Nina, Conversations About Friendship. I am your host, Nina Badson. Today's topic is one that comes up all the time, even though we don't use the words to describe it, and that is anxious attachment in friendships. Whether you are anxiously attached as you approach your friendships versus whether you are securely attached. To give you a sense of what I mean and what others mean when we say anxious attachment style, it looks something like this. If a friend doesn't text back for 2 days, somebody who's securely attached to friendships and relationships in general might think, she's busy. I hope she's okay. Maybe they might worry for the friend because they're securely attached in themselves and their own relationships. And somebody who's more anxiously attached would think, she's mad at me. What have I done? An anxious attachment style can really get in the way of your friendships. You can see how in just that one example, assuming the person is mad at you versus, wow, I hope my friend's okay, is a very different way of facing the world. And listen, in doing this work for as long as I have, I hear from a lot of people who suffer with an anxious attachment style because it's a harder way to go about your relationships. It is. And this is why I called in Rebecca Stambridge, who is known as the friendship therapist. You can find her on Instagram at the at symbol, the dot friendship therapist. In addition to being a psychotherapist, she's also a mindfulness teacher, and she helps people overcome low self-worth and anxious attachment so that they can feel secure and at ease in their platonic relationships. Rebecca lives near Manchester, England. I love her accent. When we were done speaking, she said to me, are you from Canada? And I was like, nope, I live in Minnesota. And I said to her, listening to you, I feel like I'm sitting in an episode of Bridgerton. And she's like, no, I'm from Northern England, which sounds nothing like that. How wonderful that I get to have this podcast and speak to people about friendship from all over the world. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to Dear Nina.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited.
Before we dive even more into anxious attachment theory, what inspired you in your work to focus on this area so much, friendship and anxious attachment?
A lot of it comes from personal experience, primarily. I experienced a lot of struggles with friendship through my teens and 20s and 30s as well, actually, and didn't know why. I had these patterns that meant that I was pulling friends towards me, wanting to be friends with people, anxiously kind of like wanting to get close to certain people. But then I had certain patterns that meant that I was then pushing them away, and I didn't know why. Just found friendship stressful and struggled to navigate them, and thought that I was the only one. I didn't know anything about it. I thought I was defective, that there was something wrong with me. And then when I trained to be a therapist, I learned all about attachment styles and low self-worth. Then all of a sudden, I felt like I was reading about myself, although a lot of it applied to romantic relationships. I thought, oh my God, this is exactly what I'm like in friendships. It helped make a lot of sense for me. It made sense of my experience. And then when I qualified as a therapist and I listened to clients, I realized that other people felt the same. It maybe didn't manifest exactly how my attachment pattern did, but there was a lot of people feeling very anxious about their friendships and that they were the only one and didn't understand it. So I realized that there was not a lot of information about this out there. And when I started to promote my business, write blogs and do content on social media, I realized that anytime I wrote about friendships, I just got a huge response and identified that actually this is something that I feel needs more education about. We need to be talking about anxious attachments and friendships just as much as we do in romantic relationships. Anxiety and friendships becomes the thing that I work with the most now.
That makes sense. Trust me, I see a lot of it too come my direction, but I'm not a therapist. And so I was thrilled to see your work out there, and I knew I wanted to speak to you on the show. I would love to keep this at first really basic. What exactly is anxious attachment?
Well, anxious attachment really just describes how we relate to other people close to us, just in general. So it would obviously show up in romantic relationships, but other close connections. And it's defined by, when I'm relating to this person, do I trust that they will continue to be available to me and that I'm good enough for that person to continue to be available to me? And if you're securely attached, you just have a basic sense of, yeah, I don't need to try that hard. This person will be available to me anyway. But if anxiously attached, it's completely different. You know, that faith and that trust and that expectation that people will stick around, that they'll care about you, that they love you and they think that you're good enough, that trust just isn't there as much. And it affects a lot of what goes on internally, but also affects externally as well. So in terms of how it would show up internally, one of the biggest signs is chronic overthinking. We all overthink, don't we, to a certain extent. I think overthinking is a feature of modern life. We can't help automatically wonder what's happening to a friend. If a friend's being a bit distant, there'll be a part of us that may wonder about that, think about that, and try and make sense of it. But if you're anxiously attached, the overthinking is all consuming. It will dominate everything. You can't stop thinking about it, even if you want to. You know, a lot of my clients have a sense of just almost having a battle with their mind. They can't stop thinking about this even if they want to. So all your attention is focused on that particular friend or friendships in general. But also it's the types of thoughts that you have as well. So if you're anxiously attached, you will automatically assume the worst. And that is a definite sign, a common feature of it. So if someone's been a bit distant or they haven't replied, your mind is going to go to, they're mad at me, they've gone off me, they don't value me, they don't care about me. There isn't as much capacity to take a step back and have some perspective over other reasons. The mind will automatically think that it knows, think that it can mind read, and it will always be assuming the worst. Someone will feel a sense of dread in the chest, muscles will be tense, you'll feel quite on edge, you might not be able to sleep or focus on work. So there's a lot of kind of mind and body sensations going on that represent internal anxiety. But then externally, we're looking at the behavior as well. You know, what do those thoughts and feelings make a person do differently? You're more likely to be texting your friend even more, asking for reassurance is the common one, but not even directly asking for reassurance, so subtly just trying to kind of get some contact from them by texting them more, suggesting you meet up more. So it's things that someone is doing to bring that person close to them, but also things that someone is doing to maintain that closeness. So if someone's distant, then there's a feeling of unsafety. You're trying to pull that person back. But you're probably also engaging in lots of things to maintain the relationship. Texting back really quickly, dropping everything as soon as someone invites you anywhere. Pleasing, fawning, obviously. Pleasing, adapting your personality to be what you think that person wants. So a lot of energy is going into trying to stop the person from leaving, as well as pulling them close if you think there's a sign that they might be going a bit distant.
It is such a familiar pattern. I know exactly what you're describing. There have been times in my life I have felt that way too. A lot of the people who write to me, whether it's in my inbox through the anonymous form or in my Facebook group, there's a lot of discussion that amounts to exactly what you're talking about. Even though no one uses the term, I'm feeling anxious about this relationship, that is what is presenting. And sometimes there's a lot of confusion about, somebody says they want to get together, but they didn't ask an exact plan. Like if someone says, oh, hey, you should call me next time you're going to that place, the person writing to me doesn't always know, does that person really want to get together? And they're not sure how to proceed next. Because I think people are aware that they might not want to seem like they're anxious about the relationship. And so they don't want to invite the person where sometimes I would say, not as a therapist, just as a person who's been studying friendship for a long time, why don't you say, I'm going to this place next Tuesday. Do you want to come? Sometimes we don't know if someone's interested in being friends unless we actually issue a real invitation instead of doing all these other games in a way to assess the situation. I'm just curious what you think about that.
Well, that just shows you another way that anxiety is showing up in friendships, isn't it? So sometimes an anxious attachment can make someone the opposite. They're more likely to rush into friendships and invite someone to something too soon. But you're right, also the anxiety can make someone overthink so much that they're waiting for absolute black and white reassurances that somebody definitely wants to be friends, and then that's holding them back, isn't it? And again, I suppose that comes down to, if you're anxiously attached, you have a negative bias in how you interpret that. If it seems a bit vague or a bit non-committal, they might genuinely be inviting you. It's how they word it. Then someone who's anxiously attached will just assume, oh, that person doesn't want me to go. And that fear of rejection, I want to avoid rejection, so I'm going to hold back. But then that just reinforces that feeling of rejection, because you're not establishing those connections. Overcoming that fear of rejection can help to overcome the anxiety, but it becomes a vicious cycle.
Do you find that it's coming from childhood experiences, relationships with parents and siblings? Can you talk about that?
A lot of things can cause this anxiety, this lack of confidence and anxiety in friendships. Loads of things can cause it, including ADHD as well. You know, it's important that we recognise that it isn't just about childhood, because we don't want people to come away thinking, well, if I'm anxiously attached, I must have had terrible parents. So it's important to recognise that lots of things can shape whether or not you feel confident in friendships. However, if we are looking purely at attachments and people want to understand more about that, then we really are looking at the quality of the early relationships. And it's really interesting sort of how nature has created this perfect system where we've evolved to make sure that human beings have their needs met so that we've survived as a species. So obviously babies, human babies, are completely dependent on their parents to survive, unlike other animals that can fend for themselves sooner. Babies and then children will be completely dependent on parents. So babies will, if they have a need, such as being hungry or being cold or just needing a sense of protection and closeness, a baby will start to cry when it notices a need. And that crying alerts the carer. That's the attachment behaviour. Its attempt is to get the attention of the carer. And then when it does get that attention and the carer and the baby are in close proximity, oxytocin is produced for both parties. And oxytocin is a love chemical, so it feels really good. And that's where bonding comes from parent to baby. We bond because we both feel oxytocin. So it's very clever in a way, because we learn to associate love with survival. And an absence of love is an absence of my needs being met and feeling loved. Makes us feel like we're in danger. So it's clever from a survival point of view, but it obviously causes lots and lots of problems in all sorts of relationships. And then if a baby isn't getting their needs met, so if, for example, a carer is absent for long periods, doesn't meet the needs quickly enough, isn't very good at soothing, isn't confident, or maybe just completely unavailable, then it makes sense that the cortisol will be released. And cortisol is the stress hormone which signals to a baby that they're in danger. So all about the fight and flight system. The body will be flooded with fight and flight chemicals. The heart will be beating faster, muscles tense, all those kind of feelings. And a baby will only stop being distressed when that contact is made. If it's not available, a baby is just in that state of stress for longer. The threat system that's producing the cortisol will learn to be bigger. It will learn this needs to be more active. I need to be more on guard. And if a carer does come, then I don't trust that it's going to stick around. It might drop me very quickly. So here you've got two differences in how that systems develop. If there's inconsistency or neglect, then a baby won't learn as well how to activate their own soothing system, and won't learn that actually I can be soothed and then my carer can go and I trust that it's going to go away again, so I can still stay in soothing. Whereas if it's more inconsistent, it's going to be activated much more quickly and much more readily. So yeah, those needs from childhood to feel loved and have that proximity occurs the older that a child gets, but then it takes on different forms. It's obviously not then about the physical needs. It's more about, am I listened to? Am I complimented? Am I supported? Do I feel shamed? Do I feel rejected? The child's nervous system will remember those kind of interactions and is always on guard for what can I do to get love from my parents. It's always trying to secure more love from their parents to maintain survival. As a child, how can I adapt? How can I please my parents in order to keep getting my needs met? And that becomes a blueprint then. It's known as the internal working model in attachment theory. That's how we then expect all of our relationships to be. It gets embedded in the nervous system. We learn, are people going to stick around? Will they meet my needs? Am I good enough? Can I rely on people? Can I feel calm in between seeing people because I know that they're going to come back? Ends up affecting quite a lot.
And is that a pattern you see in your own clients, that it's stemming from childhood? Or are there other reasons that somebody might come see you? And an example might be just to give people something really concrete who don't experience this. Although if you do experience this, you know exactly what we're talking about without us explaining it. Let's say a friend cancels plans. How might a securely attached person react to that versus an anxiously attached person?
If you're secure, you're probably going to be disappointed, but you don't take it personally. You just assume, I know my friend cares about me and I know they wouldn't cancel unless there's a good reason. So I'll just trust I'm going to see them again when they're ready. They must be busy. So there's an ability to not take it personally. Taking things personally is a really big part of insecure attachments. We can't help it. There's a phrase, vulnerable self-centeredness, you know, not self-centered in the normal use of the phrase, but it's self-centered in that we think everything's about us. As someone cancels, it must be because they don't care. They don't want to be friends with me. And then because we take it personally, there will be a sense of that doesn't feel safe. That distance and that rejection is making me feel really unsafe. It's likely to trigger a lot of overthinking. What have I done to them? Did I say something last time? So we're really trying to overthink to make sense of the behavior so that we can fix it in order to improve next time when there might not have been a problem in the first place.
I think what people don't realize sometimes is that if your fear is that the friend's upset with you, that there is some, you know, new distance in this friendship that maybe didn't exist before, the attempt to fix it could create more distance because now you're overly texting, you're overly making sure that the friend's not upset. And then what was actually fine, it had nothing to do with you. It can turn into, I hate to give a worst case scenario, but it can turn into the other friend being like, enough. The attempt to get reassurance from the friend can become exhausting for the person who has to constantly give reassurance.
Absolutely. And there's a balance, isn't there, I think, between healthy communication in friendships and healthy needs, saying to your friend, I'm disappointed. This is the third time you've cancelled. Come on. You know, it's important to feel you can express yourself. But ideally, that's coming from a secure base. That's coming from a place of I feel secure in this friendship so that I know that the person isn't doing this because they don't care, but they are messing me around a bit now. So because I feel secure, I'm going to express this. That's totally different to a strong reaction from fear and it being quite an automatic assumption that someone is doing this because they're not treating the friend very well. So if you're viewing the situation from that perspective, that will completely change how you communicate. You may communicate with blame, perhaps, with making that person feel guilty, with making demands on the friendship and accusing them of not caring and that kind of thing. And it's important in friendships that we do want to have our needs met by friends. But if we're putting too much pressure on a friend to meet our needs because we feel anxious and because we feel rejected, then it is putting pressure on that friendship. You want the friend to get rid of your anxiety and soothe you. And that's bound to put a strain. And it's understandable in those circumstances why a friend may find that suffocating, perhaps then want more space, which creates a vicious cycle. Someone who's anxiously attached may end up creating the very thing that they're scared of, which is people backing off from them and losing friends.
We talked a little bit just now that we should have some expectations of our friends. That's normal. You absolutely should be able to expect that a friend will be there for you most of the time. We will have to cancel sometimes. We will be late sometimes. We will take a long time to text back. That's all normal human behavior when most of us are managing multiple friendships and other relationships and possibly have kids or parents we're taking care of, romantic partners, there's jobs. Each friendship is just one of the parts of our life. I think what would be helpful to talk about is what is the healthy amount of expectation and need of a friend and what is asking too much, really?
It's such an important question, isn't it? And I think it's in some ways quite, it's a very complex picture and can be quite controversial in a way because, you know, there is a lot of information online about your friend should match your energy. You shouldn't have one-sided friendships.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up. Yes.
If your friend doesn't value you, that's not a friendship. You should walk away. It's a lot more nuanced than that.
Rebecca, I try to be a voice of reason out there in my own friendship content where I am a big proponent of you should have your own way of being and your own energy, and you don't need to match other people. If somebody is not doing as much for you, but you have a certain way you like to show up in the world, I don't say do the lowest common denominator. I'm like, you show up as you. My point is, I see so much of that online and people are all about, you should only do for them what they're doing for you. Like, no, you lead the way. You be the leader. Why do we want people to be followers? Anyway, I'll let you talk.
I could not agree more. It's a whole other episode, that, isn't it? One-sided friendships. And I think something I'm really learning myself and how I show up to friendships and the expectations I have and how I can misinterpret things is that we all show up differently, absolutely, because we're all different. Some people planners. Some people are really organized. They're the instigators. They're the person that will reach out and say, hey, do you want to do this? Or I've seen this play in 3 months' time. Do you want to go there? And that's how you are. And that's fantastic. And you should keep doing that. And then you'll have a friend who just goes with the flow, who lives in the moment, who's really last minute, who will never think to reach out and say to you, do you want to go to this thing? Because they're not thinking ahead enough. It's like type A, type B. And yeah, we can sort of read that and think they're not making as much effort. I need to walk away from that friendship, and that will be a shame, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And people are like giving up friendships that don't need to be given up because it's actually not personal. That person didn't reach out and get tickets to a show for any of their friends. It's not personal to you, but depending on how you feel secure or insecure in the world, it can be taken personally. I just want people to hear the message that I say all the time, but it's more powerful coming from you as a psychotherapist. It really is probably not personal.
I would say 90-95% of the time it isn't personal because we have these negative bias. Our mind does not know the difference between a thought and reality. So if your mind has created a thought, which is that friend doesn't care about me, it will feel real. You'll feel rejected and you'll feel physical pain. So it's hard to know the difference unless you are a therapist or you're trained in mindful self-compassion. You aren't going to know the difference. So it is understandable why this is confusing because our mind and our body is built to assume the worst and believe those kind of thoughts. Most of the time, people aren't doing what our mind is telling us they're doing. They're just getting on with their lives and maybe being a bit thoughtless. But in terms of healthy need and an unhealthy need, I mean, I suppose it is important, isn't it, to state that we still should have good quality friendships. We shouldn't be advocating expect nothing and being a friend with someone who clearly is not putting any effort in. I like to think about it as friends should be there for the highs and the lows. They should be there when you need them because you're going through a difficult time. And if a friend can't be there for you in those times or has shown a history of not being available for you to show support, that's probably a bit of a red flag. And in the highs, they should be there for you when you celebrate birthdays and good times. So highs and lows is a good way of thinking about it. And quality over quantity, I personally think is more important. And then anything in between is very subjective. One person may have needs, healthy needs in a friendship, but to see someone a lot, perhaps they're not in a relationship, they're very sociable, they like doing things with other people. So they have a healthy need to see a friend a lot, whereas they may have a friendship with someone who is in a committed relationship, perhaps isn't as sociable, and they have less needs. That's just as healthy, but the two people may have different needs, and sometimes that can obviously cause a problem. Where it might be an unhealthy need, and this is the thing to look out for that we've sort of touched on earlier, is if your needs are so high because you're expecting a friend to get rid of anxiety, that's one of the biggest things to look out for. So if you want to see your friend frequently, not because you're dissociable and you like doing things often with a friend, but because you feel anxious if they don't want to see you because you're assuming the worst, and therefore you need to see them frequently to feel reassured, I would say that's an unhealthy need. And if that continues, it's likely to put pressure on the friendship because you may be expecting more than that person can give because it's coming from a place of unmet need rather than a healthy friendship. Or you may have someone who just wants their friends to reply more quickly, again, and that's because of anxiety. So I think anything where you're trying to control the person to soothe yourself is probably an unhealthy need. Or you probably don't realize that you're doing it, but you're kind of trying to manipulate that person's behavior because that makes you feel okay, rather than being able to feel okay regardless of what your friend is doing.
Oh, that really makes sense to me. Yes, you need to learn to self-soothe instead of needing the friend to soothe that anxiety. And that's different than wanting a friend to show up for you, like you said, in hard times and celebrating times. Those are all absolutely normal expectations to have of a friendship. That's what a friendship is. Neither of us are out there advocating that you should just never need your friend to do anything for you and you should just be happy with any scraps you get. Of course not. But coming at it from a sense of fear, if you don't see this person enough or hear from this person enough, then you're going to be anxious and you need them to quell that anxiety. Yeah, that would be asking for too much. So I think we should move on to solutions. I know it's not so simple. People need to come see you week after week after week after week for years to deal with it. But some of the tools that people could be thinking about, maybe talking to their own therapists about. I'm hoping that if somebody does recognize themselves, they can look for some tools.
Definitely. And you're right. It depends on the extent of the insecure attachment. Sometimes therapy is ultimately going to be the most helpful thing. There is a school of thought and lots of evidence that the best way to heal an insecure attachment pattern is with a secure relationship with a therapist, for example. So there will always be an important place for that. But I'm a massive advocate in being able to learn evidence-based, because this is probably mainly what I did, really, learn really effective tools to manage how you feel in those situations. And a tool that I teach one-to-one and also my courses is mindful self-compassion. Mindfulness is based on Buddhism, so it's thousands of years old. It's also very much at the cutting edge of a lot of psychological interventions now. And the beauty of it is that you can do it yourself. You can learn this through meditations, through regular practices, that kind of thing. So the mindful part, it's all about trying to turn a little bit more inward towards yourself. So when we're anxious about a friend, so for example, if we're spiraling at like 1 a.m. because a friend hasn't replied, we may not realize it, but we are very maybe aware of the thoughts and feelings, but we're also kind of looking outwards in a way. We're trying to get rid of these thoughts and feelings. We don't want to feel anxious. We want to push them away. We're reacting to them with a sense of aversion, and we're also thinking a lot about the friend. All our attention is focused on the situation. So we're focused kind of outwards. What can I do to fix this? What have I done wrong? That is obviously creating a vicious cycle. So with mindful self-compassion, what you can learn is firstly to turn inwards is the noticing. It's about saying, ah, I'm feeling like this right now. I'm feeling anxious. So we name it to tame it is quite a common phrase that gets used these days with emotional regulation. So noticing this, being willing to turn towards it and recognize I'm being triggered, I'm feeling rejected. And we may not want to turn towards that because it's difficult, but we can just start getting used to naming our patterns, naming our reactions. And then the next part, which is really, really powerful, is then being curious about where we feel this and allowing it to be there. And this is so crucial in not needing our friend to get rid of our anxiety, because if we can learn to tolerate that feeling and allow it to be there, primarily in the body, we've got rid of the need for a friend to get rid of that feeling, because we are learning to be with it. And that is so important when it comes to learning how to overcome our automatic reactions with anxious attachment is tolerance. I've got this horrible feeling in my chest of rejection, and the only thing that will get rid of it is if my friend texts me. If we can learn to tolerate that feeling and allow it to be there and know, actually, this is an uncomfortable feeling, but I can feel safe within myself whilst it's happening, then that really does make a big difference to needing that person to get rid of that feeling.
That's so powerful.
Yeah. And that skill, you can learn that through mindfulness courses, mindfulness teachers. It's all about noticing the feeling. A lot of people think mindfulness is about clearing your mind of thoughts and being all zen and meditating. And actually, it's a lot more than that. It's all about being non-judgmental towards difficult feelings. And it's useful in this circumstance.
So it's sitting with the feeling. And instead of trying to push it away, it's just accepting. I don't mean just like it's so easy. I know it takes a lot of practice. It's accepting, I feel anxious right now. Name it to tame it.
Yeah, and being curious. I mean, when I started learning this, I found it incredibly powerful. You might need some support to learn to do this. Someone can give it a go themselves. You find the discomfort in the body. For example, a feeling of rejection tends to feel like a punch in the gut or a knot in the stomach. We don't want to feel that, but we can be curious about it. And we find it, like, where is it in the body? What shape is it? What temperature is it? You can't be scared of something that you're curious about. That's where the acceptance comes in. You're accepting the physical sensations that you associate with that emotion.
That's so helpful. Okay, and then so moving towards self-compassion.
Yeah, so the compassionate part is offering care to that part. Mindfulness and compassion are like two sides of, Tara Brach calls it two wings of a dove, actually, which is nice. They really overlap. And the compassionate part would start with something like, you know what, I'm feeling like this and I can't help it. I'm not choosing to be anxious. I'm not choosing to be needy or to be upset about this. You're reducing that self-criticism, because we nearly always go down to self-criticism. Why am I like this? We need to stop being like this. There's something wrong with me. Compassion, we say, oh, okay, this is difficult. I don't like that I'm reacting like this, but I cannot help it. This is just how I'm feeling in the moment. So you offer yourself empathy and a sense of being non-judgmental towards yourself. Once you do that, these three key steps, you're activating your own soothing system. You go from responding to a situation from threat, and you start to be able to respond to it from soothing, and then you're more likely to get different perspectives. You're more likely to say, well, okay, now I'm feeling a bit calmer. I've validated my feelings. Maybe there's a different way I can look at this. Maybe they are just busy. But there's loads of evidence that my friend cares about me. Why am I just taking this one example and taking this personally? So because we've activated the soothing system, we're more likely to be able to develop different perspectives and then believe those perspectives rather than try to reframe too soon when we're really, really anxious and we basically just have a battle with our thoughts in our heads. If we go down the mindful compassion route, we get these different perspectives and we are more likely to be able to take it on board. Or it might not be about different perspectives. It might just be about, well, what do I need? It's okay if you're cared for, you're good enough. So it's tapping into that need that is there, but trying to meet it yourself with soothing, compassionate words rather than what we know is happening, rather than trying to get that need met externally. You're able to meet that need yourself through these techniques.
I think that's so positive. I love the message that you can come into the world for any number of reasons with a anxiously attached nature, and you can work with it. You can have these tools to help yourself show up in the world with more security, taught through self-talk in a way, and through that self-compassion and mindfulness.
It's useful to see if this is a skill that you can learn. You know, you're, for whatever reason, your threat system has become overactive and your soothing system is underactive. And these are muscles in the brain, parts of the brain that we can build through repetition of these skills. So the more you practice it, the bigger our soothing system is likely to get and the more in check the threat system will be. I think it's useful to say that sometimes we can't entirely get rid of our anxious attachment style. We're always going to find friendships stressful. I still do, you know, and I'll say that I've been working on this for a long time and I still have certain friends that will trigger these styles in me still.
The last thing I want to talk about is exactly that, what you just said. You can work on these skills and for the most part come to your friendships with more balance in terms of, I like what you said, the threat system versus the soothing system. Bring the threat feeling down and the soothing skills up, but still there might be that particular person. I think a lot of us have that. We have one or two people that, I know the common word now is trigger. My teenagers use it all the time and they get it from TikTok and Instagram. They overuse it. But anyway, truly in the true sense of the word, a certain person could trigger that anxiety in you where other people don't. What's happening there?
And I think that's actually, as you said, it's very common, really. And when I first started doing this work, I think I expected I'd be working more on patterns in general with people who were just anxiously attached with lots of their friends. And I found that what the people that reached out to me the most, well, not the most, but probably just as much, were one particular friend that they were feeling really anxious about that triggered their attachment style. And that makes perfect sense. I really relate to that as well. And it's because our attachment style is triggered by the behaviour of someone else. It's nearly always about what's that person doing. And if someone is highly anxiously attached, then they're probably going to react to nearly all behaviours. But if you have some anxious attachments, perhaps, or you're leaning towards that anxious attachment style, then it can be triggered with some friends and not others. And I think what's quite interesting is it can be like a secure friend. They're secure, so they don't feel they have to text back that much. Because they're comfortable in their friendships. They feel that they can cancel and they know that they won't lose you as a friend because they're secure. So ironically, sometimes someone who's really secure in a friendship can trigger our anxious attachment style because of how we interpret that. And it doesn't mirror our behaviour. What we're doing because we're anxiously attached is we're texting all the time. We always reply. We always show up because we care about that person. So if the other person isn't doing that, then there's any one explanation to the anxiously attached mind is that, well, it must mean they don't care. And it isn't. It can be that they're possibly secure. Ironically, if you've got a friend with someone else who's slightly anxiously attached, you may find that you don't trigger each other as much because you're both texting quickly. You're mirroring each other's behaviour. Whereas someone who's secure might confuse someone who's anxious. But there's going to be other times when someone just is actually genuinely just very inconsistent. They may be just unreliable, a flaky friend.
We should pause for a second to just say there is such a thing as a person who is not treating you well. It isn't always your imagination. This is what's confusing to people, of course, right? Sometimes it's just that the person, like you said, is very secure and living their regular life and they do care about you and they do show up most of the time and you're just hyper-focused on the couple of times they didn't. And then there really are times when somebody is truly not that nice to you, not just canceling or not replying back, but they say stuff that's overly harsh and insensitive. There is a world in which sometimes it's not a good match for a friendship. We don't have to be friends. It's so funny. Several of my episodes have ended this way. I don't know what's going on with me lately, but I do come to the conclusion that people need to hear sometimes that we don't have to make every friendship work under all circumstances. Sometimes it really is not a good match. Sometimes this person actually shouldn't be your friend. It's hard to know because I don't like people to just be canceling their friendships all over the place because I don't think that's a good idea. But you also don't have to put up with nonstop bad behavior. It's just that we have to know the difference between what's coming from our own anxiety and what's actually ill treatment.
And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why it makes this whole thing so hard, because you don't necessarily know. And you're tying yourself up in knots thinking, is this person a bad friend or are they just a bit unreliable? I think we need to look at, is this a one-off or is this a long-term pattern? How do I feel when I'm around this person? Am I just taking one particular example and blowing up into a pattern? But really, am I overlooking something? And again, one of the problems with anxious attachments is you may be more likely to cling to that friend. So it's ironic. If you're anxiously attached, you're more likely to assume that someone is treating you badly, but you're also more likely to stay with a friend that's treating you badly because you might not think you're worth more. So you can cling to poor friendships and you may feel guilty for ending a friendship because of all the same kind of patterns. Sometimes working on anxious attachment is about having the courage to walk away from friendships that don't serve us and knowing we'll be okay, we'll meet other friends and I don't need to be friends with them.
I could see how being anxiously attached would make you stay in a friendship longer than you should for that fear of, well, this person actually knows me and has been around and what if it's so hard to make a new close friend or there's no such thing as a new old friend. So, you know, we might hold on to something longer than we should. Okay, Rebecca, we have to wrap up. Is there anything you want to leave our listeners with at the end here?
The ultimate message to take away from this is just not to be ashamed about any struggles that you're having with friendship. If you feel that you're anxiously attached or you overthink your friendships a lot and you don't know why, it's recognizing you're not defective. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It's actually a lot more common than you think. And the problem is that we don't talk about it enough. Attachment styles have entered the mainstream in romantic relationships. We talk about the clingy partner, the partner with trust issues. But then if we're having problems in friendship, who can we talk to? Because we can't talk to our friends about it. So we tend to carry around this shame, and that makes it worse. So not only are we feeling anxiously attached or we're feeling insecure with our friends, we also feel ashamed because we are feeling that way. So that's a kind of big part of this, is first of all, just recognizing there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's a lot more common than you think. Being able to be more aware of your patterns will enable you to start working on this, because you're understanding why it's happening rather than thinking it's just you, that it means there's something wrong with you.
That's beautiful and very hopeful. I'm sure listeners will have more episodes on this topic. I mean, I've had several, but not all dedicated in one episode to anxious attachment. So thank you for breaking it down for us, Rebecca. I'll have in the show notes where everybody can find you.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Bye now.
You can find me on Instagram and TikTok at Dear Nina Friendship. If you have anonymous questions you want to ask, you can do that in the Facebook group at Dear Nina The Group, or there is an anonymous form which you can find in the show notes, and I just might use that in my newsletter at dearnina.substack.com. Those answers are always a lot more intricate and thorough. But if you want other people's opinions, I would put that question in the Facebook group. See you next week when our friendships are going well. We are happier all around.